Welcome to the Deep Dive. This is the Federal News Update for Monday, November 17th, 2025. I'm Alex Johnson, and I'll be your guide.
And I'm Sam Kennedy. And Alex, we are looking at an absolutely extraordinary 72 hours in Washington.
We really are. For everyone listening, our Deep Dive today covers everything the U.S. federal government did from the very beginning of Friday, November 14th, right through the end of Sunday, November 16th, 2025. And it's a period that is, it's completely defined by what happened right before it.
The end of that massive 43-day government shutdown.
Exactly. That lapse in appropriations finally ended on November 13th, but it just left this enormous vacuum behind, you know, both operationally and politically.
It did. And what we saw over these 72 hours, it wasn't a return to normal, not at all. It was more like a desperate post-shutdown sprint where the executive branch was driving absolutely all policy. Congress was mostly in recess. The judiciary was still trying to figure out the procedural mess from the shutdown.
So all the action was coming from the White House.
All of it. And our sources really highlighted this chaotic, defining signature for this brief window. We saw what you could call executive-centric governance, where one branch did all the driving. We also saw governance by contradiction,
where policies were being rolled out even as the justification for them was being, you know, simultaneously refuted.
Precisely. And on top of all that, just profound systemic friction inside the government itself. It honestly felt like the White House just hit the gas pedal on every single high-stakes initiative it had planned for the entire quarter all at once.
So here's the key insight for you, our listener, as we get into this.
Mm-hmm.
We are basically witnessing an administration leveraging maximum, and I mean largely unchecked, power to do three things at the same time.
Right. First, they're trying to manage the domestic political blowback from rising inflation. Second, they're dramatically escalating foreign confrontations. And third, they are, frankly, waging political warfare using federal enforcement agencies as the tip of the spear.
And all of this is happening while the actual machinery of government, the mechanics that keep the country running, is struggling just to reboot after being frozen for 43 days. It's high-speed, high-stakes governance that's racking up operational debt by the hour.
It really is.
Okay, let's unpack this. We have to start with the economy and what we're calling the domestic policy contradiction.
Right.
This sudden, politically-driven reversal on tariffs. This was the very first major action, right?
Yeah.
It happened on November 14th.
Correct. President Trump signed Executive Order 14257, and it modified the scope of those reciprocal tariffs that were put in place earlier in the year. But, you know, this wasn't some broad change in trade policy. It was surgical. It was designed to hit the most politically sensitive price points for consumers.
I noticed that. The exemption list.
Yeah.
It read like a very targeted grocery list, didn't it?
Yeah.
We're talking beef, coffee, tea, cocoa, spices, tropical fruits like bananas and oranges, tomatoes, and even some additional fertilizers.
The precision is everything here. These are all products where, you know, the price is extremely visible to the average shopper. And crucially, they're all products where domestic production can't just easily replace imports.
That's a great point. If you put a tariff on steel, you can at least argue you're helping American steel producers.
Exactly. But if you put a tariff on bananas or cocoa, you are simply adding costs to a product that the consumer can't avoid, and no U.S. industry is being protected. The political calculation here was crystal clear. The cost of these specific tariffs had become a massive liability, especially after those recent Democratic election victories where affordability was the single deciding factor.
But the White House, of course, they didn't frame it that way. They didn't say, you know, we're retreating because of political pressure. They stuck to the official line.
Oh, absolutely. The official line cited substantial progress in trade negotiations. They rattled off a list of new instruments with Switzerland, Malaysia, Cambodia, plus framework deals with Argentina, the EU, Japan.
But what's so fascinating here is the tacit admission that's buried inside that executive order.
That's the real story. For months, the administration had been adamant, just vehemently insisting that these reciprocal tariffs did not increase prices for American consumers. The argument was always that foreign exporters were absorbing the costs.
Right.
So by suddenly rolling back tariffs on these specific staple goods, which are primarily imported, the administration was essentially admitting, under political duress, that yes, these tariffs had directly contributed to the high consumer costs that were causing them so much political pain. It was a policy retreat disguised as a trade win.
And U.S. industry's reaction pretty much confirmed that, didn't it?
Immediately. You had groups like the Food Industry Association praising the swift tariff relief, saying it was critical to restoring affordability. The Hershey Company, which obviously relies on cocoa imports, and the National Coffee Association, who had been a very vocal critic, they both basically said, look, for things we don't grow here, tariffs only inflate costs, and sometimes they even threaten the U.S. manufacturing jobs that process those raw materials.
And we also have to zoom in on the very muddled signal they sent to Brazil in all this.
Yes, this is a really important detail. The U.S. tariff situation with Brazil was layered. You had the baseline 10% reciprocal tariff from April, but you also had a much more significant punitive 40% tariff that was imposed later over some political and diplomatic disputes back in July.
And this executive order only touched one of those.
It only removed the baseline 10% tariff. The big one, the punitive 40% tariff, was left completely in place.
So if the whole point is to fix consumer prices, why would they intentionally leave that huge 40% tariff on a major trade partner like Brazil? I mean, doesn't that risk undermining the whole effort to lower grocery bills?
It confirms that the purpose here was purely domestic leverage, not foreign policy resolution. The main trade barrier, that 40% tariff, it stayed in effect. That signals that the administration sees it as a transactional bargaining chip to use against Brazilian President Lula da Silva.
And President Trump basically confirmed that a couple of days later.
He did. On November 16th, he said he would only reduce that 40% tariff under the right circumstances, which is code for, I expect a political concession, not just an economic one. It just shows a willingness to prioritize that political leverage over providing immediate maximum price relief at home.
And speaking of contradiction, this policy reversal on tariffs was followed almost immediately, almost simultaneously on November 14th, by this coordinated PR campaign.
The Progress on Prices campaign, yes. Yeah.
So they were fixing the prices while claiming they had already fixed them.
That is the very essence of governance by contradiction. The White House released this article, "We're making big progress on prices and we'll keep working to make sure everyone benefits." And the narrative was aggressive. They claimed they had successfully tamed Biden's inflation crisis. They cited almost $700 in real wage growth, and they pointed to price declines for specific things like eggs, butter, rice.
They even used that, the DoorDash Breakfast Basics Index to back it up.
They did. But if you're winning a war on inflation, why do you need the emergency surgery on tariffs? The gap was, it was significant.
So what was the reality check here from the outside, from the economic analysts?
Well, the external analysis immediately jumped on the distinction between prices rising more slowly, which, okay, is statistically true.
Which is technically progress, I guess.
Yeah, exactly, technically. But that's a world away from prices actually going back down to where they were before. And that's what the consumer feels. That's what they expect to see at the checkout. The reality is that most people were not feeling a victory lap was in order.
And there was another report that came out right after this that really hammered that point home.
It did. A report showed that consumer delinquencies on utility bills, which is a really hard indicator of severe household distress, had jumped 9.7% annually. When households can't afford to keep the lights on, the messaging about cheaper eggs just doesn't resonate. It shows that while maybe a few high-profile staples are cheaper, the core necessary services are straining household budgets to the breaking point.
Now, in contrast to those sort of reactive tariff cuts, the administration also locked in a pretty big deal with Switzerland on the same day, November 14th. This seems like a pure transactional win that's very much aligned with the White House's focus on trade deficits.
It was highly transactional, no question. Under the deal, tariffs on Swiss goods were cut to a 15% rate, or the MFN rate, whichever is higher. But in exchange, Switzerland pledged a massive $200 billion in direct investment during the president's term.
$200 billion is a huge number.
It is, and it starts with $70 billion next year. The explicit goal, as the USTR stated, is to completely eliminate the trade deficit with Switzerland by the end of the term.
And where's that capital being targeted specifically?
It's very strategically focused on filling gaps in the U.S. supply chain. The two big areas were pharmaceuticals and gold smelting. And we already have hard commitments. The pharma giant Roche has already broken ground on a new facility. And a Swiss company has committed to bringing gold smelting operations, a really critical step in processing precious metals to the U.S.
So this isn't just about jobs, it's about strategic materials.
Exactly. It's about reducing our reliance on foreign processing for strategically important materials. And on top of that, Switzerland agreed to eliminate all its industrial tariffs and provide new market access for U.S. agricultural products like poultry, pork, beef, seafood, things that are usually highly protected in the European market. It was an arrangement perfectly designed to satisfy the administration's obsession with trade deficits and strategic independence.
Okay, so let's move from those purely economic pivots, which were, you know, largely reactive to domestic political pressure. Let's transition now to how federal enforcement bodies were being used proactively. This is part two, the political weaponization of domestic agencies over this same 72-hour period.
And this is where that executive-centric governance was on full display, especially with the Department of Justice and the Department of Homeland Security. The first, and I mean by far the most explosive maneuver, was that rapid-fire Epstein investigation.
Okay, let's unpack this sequence, because it really reveals a clear attempt to use the DOJ for political cover. It all started with President Trump using social media, directing the DOJ to investigate Democrats' ties to Jeffrey Epstein.
And he was specific, naming people like Bill Clinton, Larry Summers, Reid Hoffman, and J.P. Morgan Chase.
And his justification was just incredibly blunt. He said, "I'm the chief law enforcement officer of the country. I'm allowed to do it."
And the speed of compliance was the real political signal here. Attorney General Pam Bondi immediately complied. She assigned the former SEC chair, Jay Clayton, to lead the investigation in the Southern District of New York. And this immediate compliance is just stunning, especially when you look at the internal documents.
Because they really looked at this, right?
They had. We know from a July DOJ and FBI memo that they had already concluded there was insufficient evidence, no predicate, to launch this kind of investigation against uncharged third parties. So they basically revived a dead investigation within hours of a presidential tweet.
So if the legal reasoning was that weak, what was the real strategic purpose of launching this investigation right then? Why the sudden urgency?
The sources are pretty clear that the true purpose was procedural. It was about defensive political cover against Congress. See, there was this highly visible, very powerful bipartisan effort in the House,
led by some prominent Republicans like Thomas Massie and Marjorie Taylor Greene,
and supported by every single Democrat. And they had successfully forced a floor vote to release all the Epstein files held by the DOJ. So this new DOJ investigation was a procedural tactic to block that vote from happening.
So by claiming an ongoing investigation, they could try to keep the documents under wraps.
Exactly. They hoped to legally invoke executive privilege or some statutory limitation to withhold those documents from Congress and the public, you know, indefinitely.
It sounds like the textbook definition of a smokescreen.
Yeah.
And it was called out as exactly that by the president's own party.
Precisely. On Sunday, November 16th, Republican Representative Thomas Massie, who is a leading figure in that transparency push, he went public. He called the investigation a big smokescreen and a last-ditch effort to prevent the release of the Epstein files. And that was politically untenable. The accusation coming from inside the GOP coalition just made the whole maneuver look cynical and desperate.
And that public exposure forced a pretty startling reversal from the president just hours later.
It did. Hours after Massey's accusation just blew the lid off the political tactic, the president executed a full public retreat. He urged House Republicans to vote for the full release of the files and then dismissed the whole thing as a Democrat hoax. The entire sequence is really significant because it's a rare public instance of the president being outmaneuvered and forced to retreat on an attempt to use the DOJ for direct political cover. The tactic just failed almost immediately because of that internal GOP division.
Now, shifting focus within the DOJ, the department also provided a crucial piece of enforcement action that just so happened to feed directly into the administration's foreign policy narrative on Venezuela.
That's right. On November 14th, the DOJ announced the successful extradition of three alleged members of the Venezuelan transnational criminal organization Tren de Aragua, or TDA, to Chile.
And this was a strategically timed action.
Incredibly so. Tren de Aragua is one of the most violent and rapidly expanding Venezuelan gangs. They're operating all across South America and, increasingly, at the U.S. southern border. The fact that the DOJ successfully coordinated the extradition of these TDA members, who allegedly committed crimes in the U.S. that impacted Chile, it provides this tangible domestic example of the threat that Venezuelan criminal organizations pose to our partners in the hemisphere.
And why was that timing so critical here?
It was essential narrative building. This enforcement action provided timely, specific justification that reinforced the administration's core argument that Venezuelan criminal groups are a direct threat to U.S. domestic security and the stability of our neighbors. This specific link was vital because it set the stage perfectly for the dramatic foreign policy escalation against Venezuela that happened just 2 days later. They were connecting street crime to state failure.
And that foreign policy escalation leads us right into the domestic action taken by DHS, Operation Charlotte's Web, which launched on November 15th in North Carolina. This seems like a perfect example of using enforcement to create a political wedge issue.
A textbook political operation. DHS launched a surge operation explicitly led by U.S. Customs and Border Protection agents, CBP agents, who usually operate near the border for interior enforcement in Charlotte, and the official press release directly targeted local sanctuary politicians for supposedly refusing to honor nearly 1,400 ICE detainers.
The language was designed to be inflammatory.
Oh, absolutely. It claimed they were releasing criminal illegal aliens back onto North Carolina streets. It was designed to provoke an immediate severe federal-state conflict, and that's exactly what happened.
And that was the intended outcome, wasn't it?
It had to be. North Carolina's Democratic governor, Josh Stein, immediately condemned the operation for stoking fear. He pointed out that similar operations in the past often end up detaining U.S. citizens or people without serious criminal records. The mayor of Charlotte, V. Lyles, called it unnecessary and politically motivated.
And on the other side,
the North Carolina Republican Party immediately praised the operation and attacked the Democrats for choosing to side with illegals over American citizens. The operation was explicitly designed to manufacture a high-visibility, emotional, political wedge issue, and it successfully shifted the national narrative right back to interior immigration enforcement.
And the cost of manufacturing that political narrative was an immediate human impact on the ground.
Absolutely. The community response was instant fear. Immigrant-owned businesses closed down in protest, local churches warned their parishioners to stay home, and most distressingly, the operation led to the widely reported wrongful detention of a Honduran-born U.S. citizen, Willie Aceituno. He was pulled from his car while shouting that he was a citizen. He was eventually released, but his detention really underscored the high-risk, indiscriminate nature of these large-scale interior surges. It showed that the pursuit of a political narrative was prioritized over careful, targeted enforcement.
Let's transition now to the third major theme of this 72-hour period. The intense focus on national security and foreign policy, which were marked by just simultaneous coercion and transaction across the globe. We have to start with the maximum pressure campaign on Venezuela, which really hit a critical inflection point over the weekend.
This was a highly coordinated escalation. It involved the military, diplomatic, and legal arms of the government all at once. On the military front, the USS Gerald R. Ford Aircraft Carrier Strike Group arrived in the Caribbean Sea. This was the apex of Operation Southern Spear, a 10-week military buildup that, according to defense reports, had already resulted in lethal U.S. strikes on Venezuelan narco boats and a reported 80 fatalities. The carrier's presence is just an unmistakable projection of power. It's meant to intimidate.
But the truly significant action, the real linchpin here, came on the diplomatic and legal front on November 16th. And this is where the policy mechanics get a little complex.
They do. This was the legal bombshell announced by Secretary of State Marco Rubio. The U.S. intent to designate the Cartel de los Soles, which the administration explicitly states is led by Nicolas Maduro, as a foreign terrorist organization, or FTO. And that would become effective November 24th.
So why is that FTO designation such a monumental escalation? I mean, how is it different from labeling them a transnational criminal organization, or TCO, which they've done before?
The FTO designation is a legal game changer. It fundamentally alters the relationship between the U.S. and Venezuela. A TCO designation that focuses on criminal prosecution, financial sanctions, an FTO designation that reframes what was a criminal entity into a terrorist threat. And that unlocks a vastly broader, legally permissible suite of counterterrorism and military tools, including targeting anyone who provides material support.
And by naming Maduro as the leader.
That's the key. By explicitly naming Nicolas Maduro, the head of the Venezuelan state, as the cartel's leader, the administration creates a legal pretext to treat the Venezuelan state itself as an FTO-directed entity.
So this provides basically retroactive justification for the USS Ford's presence and even potential strikes against the state, moving beyond just anti-drug ops to counterterrorism.
Exactly. It grants the U.S. far greater latitude to use military force against infrastructure or personnel that are deemed essential to the cartel/terrorist operation. This move really represents the ultimate escalation short of a formal declaration of war. It's a manufactured crisis, but one with severe legal backing.
And yet, right after his Secretary of State labels Maduro an illegitimate terrorist leader, President Trump steps in and plays the good cop.
Classic good cop, bad cop. Hours later, President Trump comments that the U.S. maybe having some discussions with Maduro, and we'll see how that turns out. It's pure coercion. The State Department creates this severe military and legal crisis, setting the stage for a full-scale intervention. Then the president positions himself as the only person who can de-escalate it.
Forcing Maduro to come to him.
Right. It forces Maduro to seek a personal, transactional capitulation or some kind of concession directly from him to avoid the catastrophic consequences when that FTO designation takes full effect. It's an explicit attempt to leverage a military threat into political submission.
And that transactional approach really defines the administration's policy everywhere else, too, doesn't it? Particularly with this dual-track challenge they laid down to China regarding Taiwan.
It's a very sophisticated policy, hitting both the military and economic levers to challenge Beijing's One China principle. So on November 13th, the State Department approved a $330 million foreign military sale, an FMS package, to Taiwan. But what was notable is that it wasn't for big new jets or tanks. It was for non-standard spare parts and components for Taiwan's existing fleets.
For their F-16s, their C-130s.
And their indigenous defense fighter aircraft.
Yes.
And that small package sends a massive strategic signal of resilience.
Right. The modest cost really hides the significance.
Precisely. This signals a U.S. strategy that's focused on resilience and wartime logistics. It's about ensuring Taiwan's existing fleets can stay operational and be repaired during a long conflict. And that's a direct counter to China's gray zone strategy, which is all about wearing down Taiwan's air force through constant resource-intensive incursions. Taiwan welcomed the sale, saying it was crucial to bolster air defenses against that kind of attrition.
And then came the second track, which was about economic legitimacy. On November 14th, the U.S. Treasury and the Taiwan Central Bank issued a formal joint statement on exchange rate policies.
Right, committing to avoiding currency manipulation. But what's really essential to understand is the institutional detail here. Taiwan agreed to increase its transparency by disclosing its foreign exchange intervention data on a quarterly basis. That's a significant commitment.
And what does that do?
Well, this action gives Taiwan a new layer of institutional legitimacy as a responsible economic partner. It integrates it deeper into the U.S. economic sphere, essentially treating it as a sovereign economic entity. And Beijing immediately condemned this dual military and economic action. They said it crossed the first red line in U.S.-China relations because they view that economic formalization as a direct challenge to their claims of sovereignty.
Which brings us to the ultimate high-stakes transactional foreign policy play, which is unfolding in the Middle East, F-35s in exchange for joining the Abraham Accords.
Yes. President Trump confirmed on November 16th that he is actively reviewing Saudi Arabia's request to purchase F-35 stealth fighter jets, and he made the link completely explicit. The sale is contingent on Saudi Arabia entering the Abraham Accords. He confirmed that the F-35s are being treated as a pure transactional payment for the short-term political win of Saudi-Israel normalization.
But this deal is facing just severe high-stakes opposition. It's creating a massive standoff, both internally and externally.
It creates a foundational conflict with huge long-term implications. First, internally, the Pentagon and the Defense Intelligence Agency, the DIA, they are in severe opposition. Their intelligence reports warn that China, through its growing security and economic partnership with Saudi Arabia, could get its hands on sensitive F-35 technology.
Potentially compromising the U.S.'s most advanced aircraft.
Exactly. And second, Israel has signaled its deep opposition. They view the sale as a direct threat to their qualitative military edge, or QME, that legal and strategic guarantee that U.S. military tech provided to Israel has to maintain its superiority in the region.
So what's the difference between what Israel wants and what the president is proposing?
Israel's security establishment wants the sale to be conditioned on normalization, meaning the accords have to be complete before the jets are even seriously discussed. The president is using the F-35s as a lure to start the negotiations. So by treating the F-35, a crown jewel of military technology, as a negotiating payment, the president is signaling he's willing to override the grave stated concerns of both U.S. defense intelligence and Israel's security establishment for an immediate foreign policy win. The risk of technology transfer and eroding that QME is just immense.
And as a kind of symbolic capstone to this whole shift toward a more aggressive transactional defense posture, we saw Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth personally hanging a new plaque at the Pentagon entrance.
That's right, a new bronze plaque reading Department of War.
A very visual act.
Very. And it underscores this cultural shift at the Pentagon, signaling a new ethos focused entirely on winning wars and rapid deployment, rather than the historical focus on defense. It's a powerful symbolic declaration of the administration's priorities. It's also worth noting the symbolic expense. A full, congressionally approved name change is estimated to cost upwards of $2 billion, mostly because you'd have to rewrite digital code across all of the department's systems globally.
And this focus on speed and political wins brings us to the machinery of government itself.
Yeah.
This is our fourth part, all about the systemic strain and the chaos of reopening. That 43-day shutdown left behind some massive operational debt.
It created an acute crisis that you just can't resolve with the stroke of a pen. First, just think about the federal workforce. You have about 1.25 million workers who missed roughly $16 billion in wages. OPM mandated their immediate return, but getting them their back pay is complex. It's scheduled to come in four separate tranches by November 19th. But the damage, it runs so much deeper than just delayed paychecks.
The impact on the scientific community was just catastrophic. The NIH officially called it a lost quarter for U.S. biomedical research.
And that is a profound consequence for the nation's long-term scientific future. The NIH issued guidance confirming that all of the October and November grant application deadlines were canceled. All the peer review meetings, council meetings, all canceled. This means researchers who were depending on that funding can't start or continue crucial work.
So a complete standstill.
A complete standstill. And they're being told to expect significant delays, not just in funding, but in just processing applications as the staff tries to dig out from a 43-day backlog. This is a massive loss of momentum, failed sequencing for clinical trials. It's potential long-term damage to research and discovery that we won't even realize for years to come.
And the tech agencies weren't doing much better. The FCC reopened, but its core systems just couldn't handle the activity.
The technological infrastructure literally failed. The FCC postponed its filing deadlines, but the key databases that are essential for licensing and public transparency, like the online public inspection file and the license management system, they remained offline as of November 14th.
So they couldn't even receive the backlog of applications.
They were technically incapable of it, which forced them to announce that further extensions would be required. It's a perfect example of how decades of deferred IT maintenance can lead to immediate operational paralysis when you put it under sudden stress.
We did see one critical anomaly here, which really highlights the political compromise that ended the shutdown. The FDA...
The FDA was the distinct exception, and that's because its funding was secured through the continuing resolution, which allowed it to function normally through the entire shutdown. It just demonstrates this two-tier federal system. Some agencies were deemed priority and stayed functional, while everyone else absorbed all the pain. The FDA was issuing three guidance documents on November 14th, including a draft on menstrual products, the first update in two decades. Their work just continued uninterrupted.
But on the social programs front, the shutdown's impact was measured in cold homes and empty stomachs. LIHEAP hate funding, the Low-Income Home Energy Assistance Program, was halted.
Right as cold weather was arriving in a lot of states, the timing was cruel. An HHS spokesperson confirmed they'd work swiftly, but the director of the National Energy Assistance Directors Association said it could take until mid-December or even longer for that money to reach the people who need it. That forced some states to try and backfill the costs.
And a similar story with food stamps.
Yes. SNAP benefits were restarted, but the system backlog meant some recipients might have to wait up to a week for their full monthly payments. And for the millions of households that rely on that aid immediately, a one-week delay can create a genuine crisis of food insecurity. The government may be open, but its services are still lagging badly.
And finally, under this strain, the FAA was forced to take a devastating public safety action that injected a massive bottleneck into the global supply chain, which is already stretched so thin.
This was Emergency Airworthiness Directive 2025-2353, issued on November 14th. It expanded the grounding order that followed that fatal November 4th UPS MD-11F crash. And what's critical here is the enormous scope of the expansion. It grounded not just the MD-11, but all models of the MD-10 and the DC-10 aircraft as well.
That is the entire family of classic trijet cargo aircraft. What was the justification for grounding the whole family based on one crash?
The FAA justified it based on the design similarity of the engine pylon structure across all those variants. This suggests that the November 4th crash revealed a potentially catastrophic fleet-wide structural flaw that was tied to that shared airframe design, and it necessitated an immediate, aggressive response.
And these planes are the workhorses of the cargo industry.
They are the heavy-duty workhorses of express cargo. The grounding immediately took out about 9% of the UPS fleet and 4% of the FedEx fleet. FedEx confirmed right away they were activating contingency plans, which means using slower, more expensive ground transport to cope with this bottleneck that's now been injected into the supply chain right ahead of the holiday rush. It's a critical safety failure with cascading, immediate economic consequences.
From that systemic strain, let's turn to the long-term work happening inside federal agencies.
Yeah.
I'm talking about the modernization efforts underway at OPM, the Department of Defense, and in federal IT. These are the engines of reform trying to push forward despite all the chaos.
And this internal work was ongoing despite the shutdown. At OPM, the focus was firmly on the approaching open season for 2026. And the major headline here is the premium surge. FEHB premiums are going up by an average of 12.3%, PSHB premiums by 11.3%. And that's following similar double-digit increases in 2025. This is creating a real affordability crisis for the federal workforce.
And OPM's Shane Stevens spoke about a strategic shift to try and combat these rising costs, moving away from just short-term fixes.
Yeah, Stevens acknowledged the frustrating environment and the fact that the current healthcare inflation is just not sustainable. So his long-term strategy is on two tracks. First, targeting fraud, waste, and abuse, estimating they could save around 7 to 8% annually if they could fundamentally improve the data management and security around claims processing.
And the second track is more philosophical.
It is. OPM is shifting from what they call a sick care model to a well care model.
And this well care model aligns directly with the administration's broader agenda, doesn't it?
It absolutely mirrors the Make America Healthy Again agenda. This philosophy, which is heavily influenced by HHS Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr.'s reports on preventative health, it seeks to incentivize physical exercise and nutrition over immediate, expensive prescription drug use.
Specifically going after things like the GLP-1s for weight loss.
Right. Encouraging providers to focus on positive outcomes and lifestyle changes rather than just relying on those high-cost therapeutics. The goal is to reshape federal healthcare purchasing power to favor proactive wellness.
There was also one immediate, very distinct policy change dictated by executive order for the 2026 benefits.
Yes. Carriers were required to end coverage of all gender-affirming care for 2026. OPM's new requirements state that enrollees who are mid-treatment may continue receiving coverage, but the definition of mid-treatment is left up to the discretion of each individual health carrier.
Which creates a lot of uncertainty.
A huge amount of administrative complexity for carriers and uncertainty for enrollees, because the definition of what's acceptable continued care could vary widely across the dozens of plans in the federal system.
Now, on a more positive note, for federal employees dealing with these rising costs, OPM is really pushing enrollment in flexible spending accounts, or FSAs.
An FSA is such a crucial tool. It allows federal employees to set aside pre-tax dollars, and you can save 20 to 30% on out-of-pocket costs, deductibles, copays. For 2026, the contribution limit is rising to $3,400, about $100 more than last year. It's a targeted effort to give employees a tax-advantaged way to manage those surging premiums.
And we should quickly detail a critical difference between the two major health programs regarding Medicare Part D.
This is nuanced, but it is absolutely crucial for every Medicare-eligible federal worker to know. If you're in the traditional FEHB system, you're often opted into Part D, but you can opt out and still keep your prescription coverage through FEHB. However,
in the newer PSHB program, it's different.
It's completely different. If you are eligible for Medicare and you're in the PSHB program, you must enroll in Medicare Part D to get drug coverage through PSHB. If you opt out of Part D, you lose your prescription benefits entirely. It requires really close attention during open season to avoid a catastrophic lapse in drug coverage.
Now, moving to the military, Secretary Hegseth's acquisition system overhaul is getting intense attention. It's all about speed of delivery and creating a warrior ethos in the acquisition workforce.
This is a major cultural shift. The overhaul is about empowering program executive officers, cutting bureaucratic layers, and instilling this new sense of urgency focused on battlefield needs, not just compliance requirements. The core principle is speed and mission outcomes. However, the expert analysis from, you know, veterans of defense reform like Stan Soloway is cautiously optimistic, or maybe more accurately, deeply skeptical.
And where does that deep skepticism come from?
Soloway warned that success hinges entirely on changing the deep-seated culture and developing the skills of the workforce itself. Otherwise, he said, the system will just revert to its old ways. He noted the shakeup looks a bit like the failed integrated product teams reforms of the 1990s, where the structures changed, but the human behavior didn't.
So if the workforce isn't trained or culturally aligned with this new ethos, the new structures won't matter.
Exactly. And on top of that, the strategy currently lacks any detail on the significant funding that would be required to execute these sweeping reforms, which suggests it might just stall out due to budget limitations.
And related to that, the Army's top personnel leaders, LT General Eifler and Screet Major Stevens, are pushing hard to modernize how the service manages its people. They're calling the current processes old and prohibitively expensive.
Their efforts are wide-ranging and aggressive. They're focusing heavily on modernizing the Integrated Personnel Pay System Army, IPPSA, to finally deliver accurate, timely pay and personnel records. They're also professionalizing the recruiting workforce, shifting the focus from just filling quotas to genuine talent acquisition, treating recruiting like a specialized skill.
And they're diving deep into AI to manage the sheer volume of all that personnel data.
Exactly. They're moving aggressively into AI, not to replace the judgment of senior officers, but to use machine learning to filter and categorize the masses of files for promotion boards. This lets the board members focus their limited time on the most relevant candidates, and it cuts down the administrative burden. And they're also directly commissioning data scientists and coders into the service because they recognize they have to breed that skill set internally to get to the next level.
And their internal wish list for Congress really reflects just how hard bureaucratic change is.
Their top two wishes are very telling. First, increase the speed of policy changes by limiting the number of drivers in the Pentagon bureaucracy, basically, reducing the number of stakeholders who can veto or delay essential HR policy updates. And second, a full overhaul of the civilian workforce, fixing the archaic hiring process and updating pay scales so they can actually compete with the private sector for talent.
And finally, let's look at the IT modernization efforts, especially around software licensing and the revolutionary FAR overhaul, which impacts every single federal contractor.
So the GSA has been busy under its OneGov strategy, signing 11 enterprise-wide software agreements. This standardizes terms, streamlines procurement, and offers significant discounts by leveraging the government's massive collective buying power. It's borrowing practices directly from the commercial sector to curb that systemic waste and vendor lock-in.
But Ryan Triplett, an expert in this area, noted that this progress is driven largely by the sheer force of will from OMB and GSA. What's the fundamental problem here?
The fundamental problem is the decentralized nature of federal spending. Even with these great centralized GSA deals, the process is still opt-in for agencies. And previous efforts to standardize software management have often failed because agencies just choose to opt out or modify the terms, which just creates more fragmentation. The government has always struggled with a basic lack of data on its software assets. What do we own, who's using it, and do we even need it?
And contractors are also dealing with massive, fast-moving changes from that revolutionary FAR overhaul that launched right before the shutdown.
That overhaul was monumental. It eliminated nearly a third of commercial contracting clauses in one move. And crucially, in Part 15 of the Federal Acquisition Regulation, it replaced the old, highly procedural concept of discussions with the more flexible concept of negotiations.
Why does that distinction between discussions and negotiations matter so much to contractors?
Oh, it's procedural gold. Discussions are governed by extremely strict rules with formal notifications and multiple rounds of back and forth. Negotiations are far less formal. They allow contracting officers more flexibility to move quickly to a best and final offer without all the procedural red tape. The change is meant to speed up the whole contracting process significantly.
But the immediate problem post-shutdown is that agencies are adopting these changes at different speeds.
Exactly. And it's creating this confusing patchwork of procedures for contractors to navigate. Some agencies are using the old rules, others have adopted the new, faster standards. It's a compliance headache. Emily Murphy, the former GSA administrator, gave some crucial advice here. She said contractors have to comment on the new rules, but not just on what needs to be changed. It is very important to comment also on what needs to be retained, because if the FAR Council only hears complaints, they might mistakenly throw out the beneficial changes, like that Part 15 negotiation shift.
And finally, there's a legislative effort expected to build on the success of the 2017 Megabyte Act.
Right. The push is for Congress to pass the SAMOSA Act, the Strengthening Agency Management and Oversight of Software Assets Act. This would require agencies to have a dedicated software asset management executive, professionalizing how they handle those complex vendor licenses. Experts estimate SAMOSA could save the government another $50 million a year, on top of the $450 million the Megabyte Act already saved. It's a necessary step to curb endemic software waste.
So what does this all mean? As we look back at these 72 hours, we saw a government operating at just a frantic, contradictory, and deeply volatile pace.
This period was a definitive study in contradiction, coercion, and systemic crisis. The policy was contradictory. You're desperately cutting tariffs on bananas while simultaneously claiming you've defeated inflation. It was coercive, manufacturing a military crisis with Venezuela to force a personal negotiation with Maduro. And the systemic crisis was just everywhere, from the FAA grounding a huge part of the global cargo fleet to the NIH losing an entire research quarter.
And the power vacuum created by that congressional recess is the key implication here. Policy was driven entirely by an unchecked executive branch, which led to this high-risk, high-speed, and often contradictory execution that prioritized political leverage over operational stability.
And the immediate implication looking forward is just volatility. The administration is escalating foreign policy significantly in the Caribbean, the Middle East, Asia, while its domestic agencies are either politically compromised or operationally crippled by that shutdown debt. This collision course means the government is trying to accelerate into high-stakes crises while its wheels are falling off.
And this raises the provocative final thought we should probably leave our listener with. The administration successfully used this post-shutdown window to escalate a military operation and seize control of the domestic political debate. The focus was entirely on political warfare. So given that prioritization, what core function of government, be it scientific research, defense readiness, or just basic service delivery, will be the first to break under the strain of being treated as a secondary priority to that political warfare?
You know, that lost quarter at the NIH where foundational scientific discovery was just halted, and the FAA grounding, which shut down crucial commerce infrastructure, it suggests the foundational mechanics are already under a severe existential threat. This operational debt is being incurred daily, and the bill could come due for years to come, all in the name of these immediate political or strategic wins.
Sam, thank you for guiding us through this incredibly detailed and chaotic federal news update.
A pleasure, Alex.
And thank you for joining us on The Deep Dive. We'll see you next time.